Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is the penultimate program in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. The final program will be on April 5th when Matt Bannock, CEO of the Omidyar Network, will be here. I'm Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club and your moderator for tonight's program. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Chris Daigelmeier. When I discussed the creation of this series with a friend immersed in the field of social change, he said, "The one person you really have to meet is Chris." Fortunately for me and for us tonight, I followed his advice and was delighted to meet and get to know this amazing life force that we have with us tonight. Chris Daigelmeier is the executive director for the Stanford Center for Social Innovation. But she is not just the current executive director. Chris envisioned and crafted the center into a global leader on social innovation. She has more than 20 years of management experience spanning business, social enterprise, nonprofit, and philanthropy. She has presented nationally and internationally on topics of social entrepreneurship, social innovation, private-public partnerships. Chris has lectured around the world at numerous universities and has authored groundbreaking articles on social innovation and change. Prior to Stanford, Chris worked as a management consultant to foundations, business, and nonprofit enterprises. She served as the COO for Juma Ventures and worked with the United Way of King County and the Larkin Street Youth Center. Chris received her BA from the University of Washington and her MBA from Berkeley. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to introduce to you Chris Daigelmeier.
Well, first and foremost, thank you for all coming tonight. I'm sure many of you are aware there's the Skoll Foundation in Oxford, so this is likely a less expensive alternative to find out a little bit about social entrepreneurship. And before I start the talk today, I want to make a couple overarching comments. One is I really want to thank Ruth for bringing this series to the Commonwealth Club. There are many of us here and in the room who have been involved in the field of social entrepreneurship and social innovation for a number of years. And one thing I think that is critical at this juncture is that we expand the community that we're working with. And to really propel this field forward, it's important to bring in people from all sectors, diverse walks of life. And so having something like the Commonwealth Club embrace social entrepreneurship is a really big step. Secondly, on a personal level, to make a statement about Ruth's commitment to the series. As she mentioned, she and I spoke about the series early on, and we decided my talk would fit more near the end of the series as wrapping up the evolution of social entrepreneurship to social innovation. Later in the year, I realized I had to go on a trip to China for the business school coinciding with spring break, and it didn't quite fit with the talk of this date, but I called up Ruth, explained the situation, and as somebody who frequently goes to the East, she reminded me that if I leave on the same day with the time difference, I could make it back. So with that, I am fresh off a plane from China and thrilled to be here. So I'm going to talk about three things today in our next half hour to frame kind of this evolution of social entrepreneurship and how it fits with social innovation. So first I'm going to talk about some of the definitions and how are they different and how are they similar so we can ground that in future discussions. Then secondly, I'm going to move on to a case study. We do a lot of research at the center looking at various social innovations. And I think by actually walking through the case study, it highlights some of the lessons learned about how have contemporary social innovations evolved and grown over the past 30 years. And then I'm just going to wrap up with some recommendations based on what we're learning about what we need to think about for the future if we really want to grow and move the social entrepreneurship and social innovation field. So with that, I'm sure many of you, having been part of the series, there's been a number of phenomenal entrepreneurs that have come here. You know, Bill Drayton with Ashoka, Willie Foote with Root Capital, the famous Muhammad Yunus, Mary with Shore Bank, Premal Shah with Kiva. These are all individuals that have done amazing things in their field, but what really makes them a social entrepreneur? I'm a big fan of Greg Deese at Duke University, who runs the Center for the Advancement of the Study of Social Entrepreneurship. And I do think his definition is probably the best out there that really looks at what are the fundamental characteristics of a social entrepreneur. First and foremost, they create and sustain social value. They relentlessly pursue new opportunities. They engage in a process of continuous innovation. They act boldly without being limited by resources, and they exhibit a heightened sense of accountability to constituencies that they serve. And so through his research over the past 20 years, trying to highlight, like, what makes these individuals so unique? Because the fact is, we want more of these individuals. So this is kind of the foundation and the definition of social entrepreneurship. Now, what are social innovations? So what we did at the center a number of years ago, we looked at contemporary social innovations in the past 30 years because we're aware that social innovations grow in the construct of the ecology that they're in at that time. And we did some research with luminaries in the field and highlighted about 15 that we felt had scaled to a level that they were having a certain level of impact. So these are just a few of them. Charter schools, emissions trading, microfinance, individual development accounts, and fair trade. Can you hear me when I move back and forth? Okay, just raise your hand if you can. So how do we define social innovation? Social innovation is a novel solution to a social problem that is more effective, efficient, or sustainable than existing solutions, and for which the value created accrues primarily to society as a whole rather than private individuals. And one of the unique things when we were doing this research, there was a lot of debate about, is Google a social innovation? And we made the decision that what we really thought was important for a social innovation is it needed to have the public value first and foremost. And the fact is, being out of a business school at Stanford, there are many business schools, there are many academic centers, all trying to understand the field of innovation and driving innovation in companies. There are very few doing good research to trying to understand really what propels social innovations forward. So we really thought it was important to have that distinction about public value over private value. So now we have kind of the picture of the social entrepreneurs. We've got the definition of social innovation, and you're like, are they the same or are they different? So hopefully this stool will help kind of put some meat on that question and put some distinction. So let's talk about one leg of the stool. Gets back to the social entrepreneurship. The field of social entrepreneurship has been really grounded in the great man or woman theory. How do we get more of these individuals? How do we think about their characteristics, and can we foster those, and can we educate those? And that's all very, very important. What's also happened within the field has been the evolution to also think about social enterprise. Social enterprise as a construct has been grounded in how do we have more social benefit organizations. So it's looking at business models, it's looking at structures, it's looking at what are the management talent that grows social enterprise. And so as this relates to microfinance, you have Muhammad Yunus as the social entrepreneur, you've got the Grameen Bank as the social enterprise. And what has come forth in the past 10 years is, how does capital fit into all of this? And so now we can all go to the SOCAP conference, and this emergence of the social capital markets is forefront. All these are very important, but what we really want to know is how do we get more microfinance? That's what we're really trying to grow. And the individual's a piece of it, the organization is a piece, and capital is a piece of that. But how they fit together, how they interact, when and how they evolve are really the fundamentals that we need to understand if we want to grow the field forward. So hopefully that gives like the broad view of this distinction. I'm going to kind of fill out this grid. And social entrepreneurship, as I mentioned, really focuses on the individual, the leaders of the organization. Primarily also, social entrepreneur is about startup entities. And as I'll talk later in the talk, that's a good thing, but there's a lot of limitations when we're only focused on startup organizations or new organizations to drive social change. They're primarily both in the social entrepreneurship field and the social enterprise field. They're focused on nonprofit structures. And now that's starting to change in the last 5 years, but if you really look at who we're holding out as the great social entrepreneurs, fundamentally, they're really working within the nonprofit structure. As I mentioned, social enterprise focuses on the organization, the model, the capital that goes with that. All three of these create social value, i.e. the name, so, you know, social in front of them. But what is different is social innovation focuses on the ideas, the outcomes, the process, and the solutions for social value. So you really need to look at that bigger construct and how that can lead things forward. And the last piece that I think is a very big distinction about social innovation versus social entrepreneurship is it's not defined by organizational structure. It can be for-profit, it can be nonprofit, and you can have government driving social innovations forward. And again, all these are important as we think about social impact and creating social value, but they are very distinct. And as you're doing research or as you're acting out in the community, it's important to understand exactly what you're working with and the challenges that you're going to face. So social innovation, it's about the ideas, it's about the solution, and it's about the processes. Three other characteristics that are also underpinning and fundamental to the construct of social innovation are the following. One is it's inclusive. And I know as somebody who is in the field of social entrepreneurship in the early 90s, really before there was much of a field, there was a sense of those you were either in the social entrepreneurship club or you were out of the social entrepreneurship club. And that provided some value and momentum, and that was one element, though, that I think created some barriers in terms of growing the field. And what we find with social innovation, and looking at the past ones and hopefully those going forward, it's a very inclusive construct. So if you look at climate change right now and the various players that are working in that, you've got organizations such as Walmart, to Environmental Defense Fund, to Al Gore. So it can be an individual. It can be an organization, it can be nonprofit, it can be for-profit, and it can also be foundations. And I'm going to take one break. I see some people taking notes. I am happy to share these slides with the list, if that's okay with Ruth. So if anybody wants those, we can figure that out at the end. I can give you my card. So the second one is they're solution-oriented. And as I noted before, there's been always this debate, how are social innovations different than traditional innovations? Social innovations focus on solutions. Traditional innovations focus on just the next new novel product, whatever that may be. And I like to use, I know, microfinance as an example, given the challenges it's facing, and regardless of the challenges it's facing right now, because the fact is there's 2.7 billion people without access to financial services. Microfinance has served 154 million customers. There's 7,000 microfinance institutions, and the repayment rate is somewhere between 95 and 98%. This is a social innovation that's impacting real people in their real lives, helping them to transition out of poverty. And the field of social innovation isn't focused on trying to figure out how to create more of these opportunities. And the last piece around social innovations is its emphasis on cross-sector. And we live in a very interconnected world right now. And what is happening in the world, in some cases, is they're becoming more and more silos. To drive social innovations forward, it's going to be necessary to engage government, nonprofits, and businesses in new ways. And as we looked at the past social innovations that had been successful, it underpinned all of them. It varied at what stage the interface between business, government, nonprofit came on. Sometimes it was a business nonprofit interface that was much stronger. Sometimes it was government. But in all the cases of the social innovations that we looked at, cross-sector collaborations and partnerships underpinned their level of success going forward. So those characteristics are unique and important to drive social innovations forward: inclusive, solution-oriented, and cross-sector. So now, hopefully, you have a sense of the difference between social entrepreneurship and social innovation. And what I'm going to move on next to is talking about the case study. So what have we learned as we've studied these contemporary social innovations? And what I'm going to use is the innovation continuum, because it's really helpful as you're trying to analyze process and organizations to put it in the innovation continuum. And this is pretty consistent. You have a problem, then people get together, there's idea generation, then you get that idea, there's piloting and prototyping, and then ultimately diffusion and scaling. And so I'll use this for the framework for the next case study. And what I'm going to talk about, I'm sure there's many experts in the room on climate change and emissions trading, but I only have like 7 minutes to get through the case study, so I'm only going to be hitting the highlights. But in sum, emissions trading is what is now known as cap and trade. It's a cap and trade system. And what happens in that is a cap is set on what pollutants can go into the air. And based on historical data, regulatory body then gives credits to businesses and organizations of what they can emit. If they emit less than what their allocation is, they can sell those credits on the open market. And if you go over, then you need to buy credits otherwise. And so this was a very successful innovation having to do with sulfur dioxide and acid rain. And how did this all start? It started with a huge government policy change. We should all be thankful. In particular, as I noted, I just got off the plane from China. So I'm pretty happy about the Clean Air Act of 1970 and the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency. So what we had is a problem, and the NGOs played a big role in raising the awareness of health problems and connection to bad air. We launched the EPA and the Clean Air Act. And then you had, oh my gosh, what do we do with this policy? What happened next is interesting. In 1972, the Chamber of Commerce came up with this idea called the bubble policy. And it was, we'll have these credit ideas and we'll be able to buy and sell credits, and this will be a way to drive the most effective and efficient way to lower the pollution levels. And not a lot of traction with that. At all. You had the NGOs against it, the policy regulators not really knowing what to do. And so by 1975, even with the EPA and the Clean Air Act, all the states had missed their emissions requirements with acid rain. So it was pretty much a mess. So in 1976, Jimmy Carter comes forth and realizes not a lot is going on around this policy regulation, and there's many, many challenges. And as we look at this picture, that's pretty much the stage of during the idea generation. There's a lot of fighting. There's a lack of trust. There's a lack of working together. And ultimately, then, not a lot is happening. So we move on to the piloting and prototyping stage, and it starts with 1977. I think it's just fascinating that Bill Drayton with Ashoka is the one guy who came to the EPA and actually pushed forward a lot of momentum that has led to the cap and trade. So he comes on as the assistant administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, and what he realizes is there's some nuggets there around this bubble policy, and that one of the fundamental problems with the government is it's acting like a regulator and not a partner. So what he moves forward in 1979 is another version of this bubble policy called the Alternative Emissions Reduction Option. And he realigns the whole staff of the EPA to be a partner with business. They convene conferences together. They start working in a much more collaborative manner. And there's then become some traction and piloting and actually utilization of this alternative emissions option. However, the NGOs are having nothing to do with this. They still don't trust that working per se with business and letting them have these credits could necessarily be effective. And so you have the NRDC and a number of nonprofit organizations with a big legislative battle against Chevron that kind of holds this up. And therefore, during the piloting and prototyping stage, you have government and business actually starting to work much better together, and you've got the NGOs still playing a divisive role in terms of moving policy forward. So next, we move on to diffusion and scaling. So now we're at 1990. So we have to remember we started out 1970. So we're now at 20 years, and we still have an acid rain problem. And what happens is George Bush comes, and he's going to be our environmentally friendly president and actually puts forth the provision to deal aggressively with acid rain trading and drafting the legislation. And what had happened just prior to this, NRDC had lost its legal battle against Chevron. Simultaneously, you had new organizations like Environmental Defense coming on the field thinking, well, maybe we can work with business. And what ultimately happened is the NGOs came to the table to write the new legislation. And instead of being antagonistic, things had evolved that they realized, well, this is where the wind's going. Maybe if we can help decide the legislation and work together, things will work differently. So in 1995, the new acid rain got launched in 1990 policy, and you had states, of course, California did its own regional initiatives and was very effective. You had the Northeast working together. And so by 1995, they had met their quotas on acid rain reduction. They had estimated to do this across the nation, it would cost $3 to $25 billion. It came in at $0.8 billion, less than $1 billion. And by the end of the 90s, so in 95, they hadn't quite reached 100% compliance, but by the end of the 1990s, they had reached 100% compliance with this. So what does this mean from a social innovation standpoint? I guess for me, it's like, oh my gosh, what took so long? And, you know, ultimately, that's what made it happen. And I think so if we go back to what I talked about earlier in terms of being inclusive, it changed over time. And when it finally got the right parties at the table together that could trust each other, that could collaborate and compromise, you were able to get legislation that business could act on, that the NGOs could trust, provide public value, and that the and there were many changes within the government that they had to realign to be able to effectively police and work differently with both of those entities going forward. It was solution-oriented, as I mentioned. It's compromise. And then lastly, it was cross-sector in nature. And as I go back to some of the other social innovations I mentioned, charter schools and fair trade, they have different trajectories, but those same underlying principles at various stages help them get to the next level. So what does this mean for the future? I started out with some of the social entrepreneurs that Ruth has brought here and, you know, talking about them as individuals, but what we really want to be talking about are what are their ideas. So Mary at Shore Bank, she's about community banking. That's what we need to drive forward is community banking. Kiva is a great organization. Jessica Flannery worked at the Center for Social Innovation, so I'm kind of proud of that and actually went to Stanford. But that's an innovation about peer-to-peer lending. So I think it's important to grow Kiva, but it's equally important to grow that social innovation of peer-to-peer lending. Willie Foote is about social investment funds. He's doing amazing work around the world, but how do we think of growing his idea around social innovation funds? And Conchi is really with the elderly, how can assisted living reduce healthcare costs and improve the quality of health as the community ages? So this is what we really need to be thinking about. And there's three recommendations I would say we have for the future. And one is never mistake a clear view for a short distance. We've seen over and over again the time frames that take to get social innovations to a scale where they can have an impact, and they're not short and they're not sexy. And I get a lot at the center of launch pads and new hubs and incubators, and I think those are all great things. But what's really going to make the difference is the long haul to be getting to scale. And what we've seen over and over again is through idea generation, you know, everyone's excited, and then they get to piloting and prototyping, and then they fall in the chasm. There are very few social innovations that make it over the chasm, and there's a number of reasons for that. Because what it takes as an organization and ideas to move from piloting and prototyping to diffusion and scaling, it takes a different capital, it takes different talent, and it takes a tenacity that I think our society is lacking right now. I think it's lacking of us as individuals to hang in there for the long haul. I think it's lacking of many funders out there and many actors that make it very difficult to go to that long haul. And while I know that I'm comparing apples and oranges on this slide, I just find I like it. So what we have here is you look at Grameen Bank that started in 1975. It took 20 years for it to really even make a dent in terms of reaching millions of people with loans. What I think the appetite is, everybody wants the next eBay, but the fact is there's not a next eBay out there for social innovation. I would say Kiva is probably the closest one right now. And if we can change our mindset to support that longer-term time frame, I think we'll actually get social innovations to scale in a much more effective manner versus always starting at the beginning block of what's the next new idea. So going forward, I think it's critical that we change our systems, our structures, and our mindset to think about the long haul. Secondly, this is kind of a bad picture, but you really need to find your lever. And what we found as we looked at these different social innovations, when they're at that piloting and prototyping stage, you're trying a bunch of different things, and that's all good. But there could be one thing that's going to help you make it up that curve. And so, for example, fair trade was when they really started focusing on consumer demand. How do you change consumers' awareness and buying patterns that are different? And secondly, also making a quality product that's equal to those with or without fair trade. When I was fortunate enough to have dinner with some of the social entrepreneurs here and also a number of social entrepreneurs I see down at Stanford. And I find whenever I'm talking to them on a one-on-one basis, they usually have that idea of what their lever is and what that nugget is. But what I find is often missing is the time for them to figure out how to make it work. Because the funders and whoever, they want change in the next quarter. And sometimes it's going to take a year or two to move that differently. And so as I look at like Willie Foote on the social investment funds, in his talk, he just alluded to starting to work differently with corporations. I would, you know, surmise that that might be a new lever versus the nonprofit funding to make things go forward. The one thing I find at Stanford right now is the depth and interest in sustainable supply chains has never been higher. And all of these companies are really struggling with how to do that. And boy, couldn't we match better what their needs are with what's going on with some of these social entrepreneurs? Similarly, Mary talked about community banking, and she made a statement like, we fundamentally need to change work how we work with traditional banks. So if we need to look differently at community banking, how can we make that change? And then lastly, as I mentioned, I think fair trade's first lever was consumer behavior. Some of you may be familiar with an organization called B-Lab, which is trying to change legislation around the country so as companies incorporate, then they can include a triple bottom line. Maybe that's the next lever to get fair trade that was launched in 1949, the idea and where we are in 2011, up that curve and really start taking more bulk and growing the types of products that are offered and the consumer demand. And then lastly, it's important to internalize a cross-sector philosophy. And my concern with this one right now is everybody's talking about it. Nobody knows how to do it. So I was teaching a corporate social responsibility course this last quarter, and I was randomly pulling, you know, going on Google, looking, doing some Google searches. And this is some of the things I came up with. If you want to know about business strategy, you have 129 million hits on Google to go look. Obviously, people care about this right now. They're doing the research. They're writing books, helping people figure out how to do this better. If you're interested in nonprofit strategy, you've got 7 million. If you're interested in business partnerships, you have over 7 million. If you're interested in cross-sector collaboration, 509,000. We don't know very well how to do this, and I believe that this needs to be the next level of investment, both on academics and practitioners and businesses working really hard to figure this out. Because if we've looked at social innovations over the past 30 years that have scaled and cross-sector collaboration infused all of those, then I think it's a good indicator that it's going to be necessary to have that going forward, and we really need to up that knowledge to be able to do that. So I am now closing, and you need to always close with somebody really important. And as Bill Clinton says, if we want to build a stronger, more sustainable world for future generations, one with more partners and fewer enemies, we have to work together. And we're all in the solution business. And the fact is, the solution business is complicated. The underlying causes are complex. And what it's going to take to drive those future solutions is a lot of work. It's going to take finding the lever. It's going to be in an inclusive manner. And I see that as an opportunity, and what I hope is through series like this around social entrepreneurship and social innovation, it's motivating people to become engaged and to act differently, because the future is going to depend on it. So thank you very much.
Our thanks to Chris Deigelmeyer for such an insightful talk. And now I'm going to sit down and you're going to stand up.
Okay.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, I have lots of questions here, and feel free to add more in. It seems to me that you used the term social innovation throughout the series. I've thought about it in terms of systemic change. So it seems like you could put social innovation in the way you were using it and systemic change as the same notion versus an entrepreneur doing a discrete activity. Is social innovation systemic change?
I think social innovation has the potential to lead to systemic change, but I think there's incremental and radical social innovation. And I don't also want to leave the incremental social innovation not getting resources and discussed too. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, the ultimate goal is systemic change, and we should all shoot for that. But sometimes you need incremental social innovation on the route to get there. So, and I also think you go back to, I know Sally Osborne was here of their definition of social entrepreneurship, the whole ecology changes. Well, we don't have an example of that then right now. So I think at some level you do a disservice to set the bar too high that's unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And so I think you set the vision and the goal out there, but along the way it may come in blocks, it may ebb and flow, and we want to be inclusive of that also.
So, Chris, in the list of social innovations that you gave early on, carbon trading, climate change, microfinance, et cetera, What do you think? Why those? Why did those work? Because there, you know, there's nothing in health, for example, and in education, it's charter schools. But there's a lot of different kinds of charter schools, and you might even say there's apples and oranges and pineapples in that group.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what's the common? Why those, and why not others? Or is that too broad of a question?
Well, first of all, it's not the whole list. So what we did, but you have to start somewhere when you're kind of doing your research and you're trying to put definitions and understanding together. So I think what we found going to experts out in the field, these were the social innovations that had reached a level of scale. So there was a certain confidence and level of impact. There had been evaluation on these in terms of some of the more nonprofit ones around rigor. And that the field had kind of anointed these as, oh, yes, these have made an impact in the last 30 years that it's worthwhile looking at. And I do think we don't want to kind of limit, we want to be broad, whether it's education, environment, or health, because what we also hopefully will find are when things are successful maybe in the environmental field, can that be translated into the health field? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to answer your question, it's not the whole list. Why we chose those is because that was what the research came back from the field.
Okay. Throughout the series, as you mentioned, there's been a focus on the individual entrepreneur and this notion that there's kind of this person riding forward, you know, with his or her idea and going to, you know, change the world as a result. Our last speaker, Louise Packard, works with a faith-based organization, and she was saying, true innovation is the ability to get existing organizations and resources to do what you want them to do, which is very different than this notion of the kind of lone ranger social entrepreneur. What's your take on that? Is working effectively with a team and garnering resources that are already in existence part of social innovation?
Absolutely. And again, I if I'm stranded on an island, I kind of want to be with the social entrepreneur because they're so resourceful. But as we look at the structure of the world now, I'm not saying this is a social innovation, but an example of why you need to work with existing organizations. Walmart has done more for sustainability via its supply chain than many social entrepreneurs I know in the environmental field. And to move the social innovations forward, we have to work with those existing organization in pockets because they have the footprint, they've got the resources, and they've got the strength to usually move things forward more quickly than that startup organization. And again, I think I go back to, you know, eBay, the slide with eBay as the example. There is no social entrepreneur organization that's had a growth trajectory like eBay. So I think we are really limiting ourselves to just think of new organizations to solve these social problems.
Right. And, you know, some people would argue that one of the greatest social change mechanisms was obviously the invention of the birth control pill, but also the invention of the washing machine. And those were both for-profit
yes.
activities. So let's talk about the role of the corporation. You mentioned Walmart. What are some companies that you think are kind of at the cutting edge of social innovation? In addition, or do you want to flesh out the Walmart example?
Well, I'll just highlight a few. And I think when we're looking at the companies, you know, some of them are doing traditional, you know, corporate responsibility efforts. But I do think Walmart is an example of through its supply chain of really driving social innovations forward, working with NGOs and partners and using technology in new innovative ways that have really increased, you know, or reduced their carbon footprint. And And I think, in particular with Walmart, as it's going deeper in the supply chain, it's starting to work with governments in country. Again, it has a robust experience of working with NGOs, that you need to include those as you're thinking. And then, secondly, what are some other companies? I think there's Nike is doing some really innovative work around cradle-to-cradle thinking for all of its products. It's been working on it for 10 years. It's at step one. It's still in its idea generation phase. Mm-hmm. But if a company like Nike can start thinking differently, like every shoe would be recycled, and they'll go back into playgrounds and start working with NGOs differently, there's huge opportunity for social innovation through those companies. And again, just coming back from China, the role of business is too large to not aggressively work in a collaborative manner to solve the social problems. They have to be a partner. I fundamentally believe there's no other choice. I think there's a huge role for NGOs, and that's critically important too, but we've got to move past this stage of the NGOs are good and business is bad to think of how do we pull these entities together differently.
Unfortunately, C.K. Prahalad died untimely, early. He was the author of The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid and was going to be in this series before he passed away. And so his whole contribution to this whole discussion is the fortune at the base of the pyramid, which is now the more politically correct way of saying the bottom of the pyramid. But has your center or do you know have looked at that? Because you know obviously there's a lot of people and a lot of consumers at the base of the pyramid. And what is marketing specifically to the base of the pyramid part of social innovation?
I don't know. To be honest, I don't think we've looked at putting it in or out of I think you need to go back to the definition. Is it new, novel, efficient, more effective, that creates public value over private value? And if it meets that definition, I think it should be included. I think in the field right now, sometimes there's a debate, which I find somewhat paternalistic, like, you know, oh, we're just selling things to poor people. I'm like, well, why should I be able to have something and somebody, you know, not who is at a lower income level? So I don't want to kind of get into the moral kind of debate around consumerism at the base of the pyramid, but they're a constituency that wants to move out of poverty. Commerce is going to play a piece of that, and I think we can leverage that. And an example right now is Unilever, the woman who runs their like soap division. If you can get people at the base of the pyramid to wash their hands more, you're having a major impact in health in those communities. Mm-hmm. And I do believe, from what I've read right now, the for-profit model for that particular intervention is the best strategy versus a nonprofit model. And again, nonprofits can do things around an education piece, but actually getting the product to the people at the right price that's affordable, I would say probably, yes, Unilever is in a good position to do that. And so I think there can be social innovations at the base of the pyramid that can really improve people's lives also.
Okay. There's a question that you said about the fact that you highlighted Walmart and Nike, and that those have been the recipients of a lot of negative publicity in this country. And as Chris knows, I spent a lot of time in Asia, and people say, well, how are companies in Asia different? And one of them is there are not there's not as much consumer activism in Asia, so there isn't as much public pressure on companies to do the things that Nike mm-hmm. and Walmart did. Is it your view that that kind of negative advocacy or the advocacy that focuses on a company, it needs to be in place before they do, in fact, the right thing?
I hope not. I think at various times, it's been a very effective tool. And so I do think getting the awareness out on Nike around sweatshops was necessary and really fueled the company to move in a different direction. And I think continuing to have that sharp eye on our businesses around accountability is necessary. I don't think that will ever go away. But I think regulation plays a piece of it too. I think in a lot of these developing countries, potentially a better strategy is actually working to develop good democracy and good regulation mm-hmm. around companies. So you don't want to forget about that piece. And I think over time, hopefully setting up different norms of what's okay to do business. And if you look back during the industrial age here, yeah, it was okay to dump toxins into the water through, you know, steel and so forth. And now that's not okay. And they're not, you know, so regulation has changed. The expectation has changed. Awareness has gotten a lot higher around climate change and health issues. So we want to leverage all of those tools to drive social innovations forward. So specifically, to those companies in other countries that maybe are less socially accountable, hopefully we're using all our carrots and sticks to improve that situation.
And I think that's happening. They tend to be moving in that direction.
Yes,
anyway.
A little slowly, but yeah.
And, you know, it was mercury poisoning in Japan that really drove those companies to be leaders in environment. Who knows what's going to happen to them now? They might really innovate away.
Yeah.
Certainly they have the opportunity. One of the issues that we've been kind of talking around and has been a theme of this whole series is the kind of that social entrepreneurship blurs the demarcation between profit and nonprofit mm-hmm. in addressing social issues. And some people have fairly religious positions on you have to be nonprofit or you have to be for profit. You worked at a nonprofit that had a sustainable income stream, Juma Ventures. What is your feeling? Is there a particular rule, or is it anything goes, or are there lessons that we've learned about the relationship of nonprofit and for-profit in bringing about social change?
I think we're at the early stages of figuring out these new models. I think for-profit social purpose businesses, we still have a lot to learn, and we're going to try some things, and then we'll also have some failures along the way. But so back, you know, specifically answering your question, I think you really need to look at your mission, and you need to prioritize what is important in terms of the earned income stream versus your social mission. So, for example, when we were at Juma Ventures, we were a nonprofit and had these for-profit subsidiaries. And some of those subsidiaries, our businesses had an earned income stream, but the mission was so, number one, that some of those businesses lost money and we were okay with that. So we could never have existed as a for-profit entity because we made a decision that the social mission would always be first. Similarly, so you've got to look at the mission, and then you've got to look at what your capital requirements are, and then you need to look at, which I think is always important, is jump ahead to think of past that idea generation of how would you scale your organization or scale your idea, and that might lead you to a different decision. So for us at Juma, it made the most sense to be a nonprofit with these for-profit subsidiaries. I'll give another example of a student for-profit organization that launched a few years ago called D-Light. So D-Light was started by a Stanford student at the LED lights that for areas in the world that don't have electrification and that are using kerosene to replace that. Their initial idea was they would be a nonprofit structure. I mean, it was very mission-driven. It was around, you know, saving the environment, increasing, helping people out of poverty. When they actually started to look at the capital structure, there was no way they could have scaled as a nonprofit. So they made the decision to go the for-profit route. They've been able to raise much more capital and have sold 2 million lights to date because they made that decision to be a for-profit model. So I think, you know, we're starting to learn more about these structures, but as it is right now, they're very individually based, looking at your mission, what are you trying to achieve, who are you going to serve, where are you going to get capital, what are your opportunities for scaling. I think, and I definitely, on a personal level, believe wholeheartedly we have to engage business differently, and that for-profit social purpose businesses are important and can be of huge value to address the social problems. And I also believe in really strong traditional nonprofits, and not everything should be for-profit, that we need all of those as part of the solution.
There's a couple of questions, Chris, on measurement and efficacy. If you don't have one of the changes that's happening is that there's this need now to measure, and this must be true at a business school such as Stanford. So what are your big takeaways about measurement, and what do you think people need to keep in mind when the focus is on measurement?
You could have a whole series on measurement.
No thanks. I just want one pithy comment.
And one pithy comment. So I don't know if I'm going to get to the pithy comment. And really, kind of ironically, the business school around social impact and measurement is not really far ahead in that arena, because their solution is if people are paying for it, that's kind of their measurement. However, at the Center for Social Innovation, we definitely care about this work. And where we find there's traditional measurement on your nonprofit and your impact, which, again, has to be tailored. Are you in health? Are you in education? And that what I think is important, this hopefully maybe will meet your pithy comment, you need to align the measurement with the stage of your organization. So if you're in the idea generation stage, pick a couple things you're going to measure. Don't kill yourself on some huge evaluation methodology of interviews, because what you think is going to be your intervention is likely going to change. Mm-hmm. And so I think you need to do your best guess, your hypothesis, do quick, and then as you, through your idea generation stage, you get to piloting and prototyping, you need to move to be a little bit more rigorous and start thinking in a more systemic and deep manner around measurement. And then, if you're really going to go to diffusion and scaling, you better be investing heavily in measurement. So what I get frustrated with is nobody differentiates the stage of innovation aligned with measurement. Mm-hmm. Or I shouldn't say no one. I would say a number of foundations and investments. They just want, they put everybody together, and I think that does a disservice for what they're requesting in terms of impact, and I think it really does a disservice to the organizations, both from a resource allocation standpoint and the ability to innovate and continually improve. So hopefully that response is align your measurement with the stage that you are of an organization.
There's actually, it's quite interesting, there's a few questions about the term innovation. So historically, you know, it was often connected with design. And now we're getting back to design as a really important way to innovate. And like Stanford School of Design has huge offerings about this, and IDEO is making a fair amount of money as a consulting firm looking at design for innovation, and the Lemelson Foundation is funding in this area. What's the connection there, and what do you think is kind of exciting about that trajectory?
What I think is exciting about design for social change is So two things about it. One is the focus on the consumer or the customer. So it's all grounded in a level of empathy versus, as we know with international development, taking a Western idea and thinking it's going to work in South America. So I think, You know, we support a number of classes at Stanford, the Entrepreneurial Design for Extreme Affordability, and we're actually, I just had students in Myanmar to Ethiopia, around the world, looking differently at kind of the customer needs. So what I think is exciting about that is their focus on empathy. I think the other piece that's exciting about that is they're reinforcing with some stagnant kind of players in the world. You've got to iterate and try things. So it is creating this culture and acceptance of trying and being innovative, and that's a good thing to do whether you're a large or small organization. So I think those two elements are very positive. What concerns me is the sexiness about it. Like, oh, we have our solution now, design for social change. And people will lose the focus on what I said as the wrap-up. You need to focus on the long term. It's about execution. So design is only a piece of that puzzle. The fact is, it's where real things happen is when you deliver a product, you deliver a service in the execution stage. And I don't think they've necessarily figured out that the connection between design thinking and execution. So at one level, I get any of these issues, I get concerned about the hype, that people are always looking for that next new sexy thing, and what gets lost is people's tenacity and perseverance to go the long haul. So I think it's a good tool to have in our toolbox, but that's, we still need the whole toolbox. That's not the solution for everything.
So the long haul is a good segue to our next set of questions, because you gave that very powerful case study about carbon trading. And as you said, it took 30 years, and there isn't a hero or heroine in that group. I mean, there's many, but you can't say, oh, Bill Drayton. Yes, he was at the EP. And so there's a lot of energy around social entrepreneurship and social innovation now as an individual who's going to go and make a difference in the world. And if you say, well, it's going to take 30 years, and people may or may not know that you had this, you were the cog in the wheel that moved this forward, what does that do for the energy and the appeal to primarily young people to move into the field? Or your students, for example.
Yeah, it's hard to say, be a cog in the wheel. especially when you're in Silicon Valley. What I think, but there's also the importance to talk about the truth and the reality. And I think people are starting to question a little bit about the heroic social entrepreneur right now. And I think that's okay to do. And it's okay to think about systems and about execution as the driver for social innovation. And so I think the bigger, you know, question or solution, can somebody make that sexy? Because I sometimes feel like the challenge we all face is everybody wants sexy and new, but solving social problems, we haven't had those successes in the past. There's not that sexy or new thing. It takes a different mindset, a different toolbox to do that. So to answer your question, I would say I don't necessarily know the answer. Mm-hmm. Students, young people, I think you can move them to act. And if they want to do it in a social entrepreneurial way, that's great. They're adding value. But I feel what we're trying to do at the center, and we were very deliberate of picking social innovation. And it was funny because when I got there, people were like, you should be the center on social entrepreneurship. And we're like, no, we are the center on social innovation. And here's how they're different. And if we can raise the awareness of the value social innovation provides and raise awareness of the benefit of working within organizations, and you can see that impact, hopefully that will be just as sexy as the social entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So I do know of those individual cases of the woman who thought, oh, should I be a social entrepreneur or should I go in the soap division at Unilever? And she literally looked at the calculation and said, I have the potential to have a much bigger impact as an individual working within this large corporation. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't always have to be new. So if we can raise the importance of the impact piece, raise the importance of the level of community and, you know, multiple individuals, hopefully we can get more people to do that just as much as they want to do the new thing.
Chris, there's a couple of questions on the role of a business school, and this, of course, came up with another speaker who came from Duke. And there's almost a sense that the truly empowered want to be social entrepreneurs, and the real need is among the unempowered and the people who have who are closer to the issues, you might say. What's your take on this? Is it kind of like a cool thing to do for empowered people in this country? Or as you look across these many, many innovations and changes, do you see people from all aspects of the kind of socioeconomic backgrounds entering into this kind of thinking?
So
is that a clear question?
I'm going to pull the question apart and then let me know if I had the question.
Okay.
So one was the role of business schools, right, which I think is actually a different question than do we see in the field the social entrepreneurs coming from the community versus more privileged people engaging in the field of social entrepreneurship?
Very good. Yes, answer both of those.
Okay.
Okay.
So those are two different questions.
Okay.
So on that level, do we see people from the communities moving social innovations forward? Yeah, if you go to India and you go, you know, to Pakistan, we run an executive program for social entrepreneurs. And in that case, we see those local entrepreneurs. They're doing hard work on the ground in their communities. What you don't see is them getting the visibility of the Kivas of the world. So I think they are out there, and I'm not a media expert of why they don't get the same kind of recognition as some of the other, you know, for lack of a better word, more privileged people who choose that career path. I don't know if it's because it makes a sexier story or it's easy. So we're seeing some of that. I think it would be nice to see a lot more of that. And there's a lot of work, you know, that needs to be done to foster that, to give people the tools to do it. Because it's not enough to have an idea. You have to have the toolkit to be effective to do that. So that gets back to the role of business schools. I think there's a number of centers and business schools. We're doing the best that, you know, we can do right now, but it's also, I'm pushing a big boulder up the hill. having a center for social innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business is not always an easy sell with faculty. And so I think within universities, what we see our role being around social and environmental issues is raising awareness, building skills, and inspiring action. What I think business schools can and all academic universities should do a lot more of is the inspiring action piece. We're pretty good at raising awareness, but you know what? Just because you know something doesn't necessarily lead to change. And that's a fundamental shift from a financial and programmatic investment. So I know, like, when we launched our Social Innovation Fellows program and we launched these service learning trips, it was a huge sell for me to get these through the politics at a university because it just didn't fit their checkoff box of how universities operate. Mm. So, you know, in the landscape, business schools have a role to play. And I think, I was just on a trip to China with 20 students. Having them have that experience in country, on the ground, will stay with them for a longer period than just learning about China in a case. And it's through those types of interventions, if many, many schools start doing these types of things, hopefully we're building a different kind of leader. And what I always say at the center, yes, I want to support those social, and we have a bunch of social entrepreneurs, Jake Harriman from Nuru and Sam Goldman from Delight, and they're doing great things. But wouldn't it be equally beneficial if the next person who's head of Goldman came through the Center for Social Innovation and thought a little bit differently about the role of financial institutions and its impact in the community and society? Mm. And I'm hoping, you know, business schools will take a more active role in, you know, raising awareness and really educating leaders to help solve social and environmental problems. And that's not the mission right now.
That's a great answer to both of those questions. And let me just ask you the last question. So the White House has a social innovation fund. What grade would you give them for that fund, and what are they doing right, and how can they improve it? In about 1 minute.
In 1 minute. First, I would say it's too early to tell. And with all of these type of endeavors, you have to give them a little bit of time to do their job and to do it well. So I don't want to fall into what I often criticize of wanting social change in the first quarter. So with that, I think it's important to evaluate them once they've given the funding, once they've evaluated. I think they're doing a good job of trying to do something new and move the idea of social innovation broadly within the government. From an operational standpoint, yes, they definitely made a few missteps. But in the scale of things, for how big they are, I think there just was more gossip about it than what was really there. There's a lot more money going through the Department of Education and Health and Human Services than that's going through the White House Office of Social Innovation. So with, you know, my comment there, support them to do the best that they can do and do an evaluation in a year or two after they've actually delivered some funding and have time to see how it works.
Okay. Our thanks to Chris Steigelmeier. We also thank our audience here on the radio and on television. Tonight's program has been the penultimate program in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. I'm Ruth Shapiro, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.